After months of campaigning and debates, months of leaks and tweets and videotapes, months of bad hombres and nasty women, pussy grabbing, deleted emails, dirty money, finally, this whole ugly, degrading, stressful election is about to be over. I'm Anne Strangechamps, and on November 8th, finally, you and I get to walk into a polling place, pick up a ballot, and cast our one and only personal and private vote. Oh, did I say private?
The fact that you voted is public information. What's not public is who you voted for. That's secret. But the thing is that these guys have so much information on us, our demographics, like the kind of newspapers we read. Like, they can infer so much about us that they might as well know who we actually voted for.
This is Kathy O'Neill. She's a data scientist, and she says there's one thing about this election you might have missed. You were micro-targeted. So these days, political campaigns know everything about you. They know your gender, your occupation, where you live, where you shop, what you buy, who your social network is, and what websites you look at. So you tell me, what do you think they do with all that information about you?
Okay, so let's say they have a candidate, and let's say that candidate has like 17 different opinions about policy. So they're going to have, for any person, you, they're going to have a score of to what extent you agree with the candidate on those policies. Now, they'll also have a score. To what extent are you persuadable? So they'll send different advertisements, different sort of campaign ads, I should say, to people on Facebook showing this ad to that demographic and a slightly different ad to a slightly different demographic. Facebook, just to be clear, step back. This is what Facebook makes money on.
So this is way beyond a blue and a red Facebook feed.
It's much more targeted. So, you know, I heard that after the second debate, and it's probably true after the third debate, but I heard after the second debate that both the Clinton and the Trump campaigns had so many different Facebook ads that would, depending on the ad, would send them to hundreds of different websites that they had set up just for that one debate. So that literally their web designers are creating different landing pages mm-hmm. depending on which ad you saw on Facebook. And by the way, if I went to or you went to the candidate's website to get more information about their stance on policies, they would be tracking you with cookies and they would show you what they want you to see.
Wait, if I and somebody else go to Donald Trump's website, we're going to see different things on
Absolutely.
That website.
Yeah, because websites nowadays are created when you get there. And that's the kind of exactly the kind of thing that political campaigns want an edge on. They want to say, oh, who are you? What will you respond positively to? We're going to create that for you, that environment. And by the way, we're going to tailor and curate the information that you get to see.
You know, that goes a long way toward explaining something I've wondered about, which is why this election in particular seems to be divided into such hardcore camps who often seem to be talking across each other. And more than that, they really each think the other one is lying. They're just absolutely convinced. Well, if we're being fed and receiving different information, then that explains why.
Yeah. Let me just throw in one more.
Yeah.
Like, we have the Facebook trending algorithm, which they recently fired all their human curators and like left it up to the algorithm. And the algorithm is sometimes sort of suggesting that people read news that is not even real news. It's actually fake news. We've had a proliferation of fake news websites that are created simply to manipulate people. And because Facebook and for that matter, other platforms are not taking responsibility for curating, this stuff is wildly successful, and it's degrading our concept of what is actually news and what is just made up.
So the larger picture that you're talking about is complex data algorithms that are now permeating most kind of interactions we have online. And because we don't see them, because they're not transparent to us, we have no power over them and we don't even know we're being manipulated. Am I getting this right?
I think one of the things that's scariest to me about, especially about the political information that is being disseminated by campaigns. Mm-hmm. And the story I like to remind people of is like the Mitt Romney 47% speech. So he gave that speech to a bunch of hedge fund, you know, millionaires in a private club. And he said, okay, well, 47% of this country is never going to vote for me. They're like the takers. Now, we didn't hear about that because the millionaires at that function were outraged and told us. We heard about that because there was a bartender who secretly videotaped it and then leaked it to the press. So in other words, to be clear, what I'm saying about that is politicians curate their speech. They give people what they want to hear. What we have now is like a system, a big data version of that, where you're not going to get it leaked from these people who are hearing weirder and weirder things because it's what they want to hear. And there is no bartender in the room.
It's just an algorithm.
It's just an algorithm. It's a private message. We don't, like the press, like you cannot keep track of what's going on. What are you saying to these various people, you, the political campaign?
So I can't call up the Hillary Clinton campaign and say, I want to see every message you've sent out to every micro-targeted group.
Correct. As I said, hundreds of different messages to hundreds of different types of people. How could you possibly keep track of them all? So, like, in other words, I'm basically saying the press has a historical responsibility of keeping politicians honest. And the way they used to do it is they used to travel with these politicians from town to town and say, hey, you said this to this town, and then you changed your tune to this town. And they would report that. They can't do that anymore.
I suppose it's the takeaway message, I guess, is consumer beware, as in information consumer beware.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I want to make sure that I'm not leaving with the message that it's up to the individual to deal with this, because it is so systemic and it's so huge that if we did that, then very, very few people would actually protect themselves, right? So I protect myself with respect to this information filter bubble by reading very, very like explicitly reading stuff that is not being fed to me. Like, I go out of my way to read stuff that I disagree with because I want to keep track of that. But not everyone is going to do that. Not everyone has time to do that. Mm-hmm. We have to figure out a system that works better than this.
Kathy O'Neill is a data scientist, author of the blog mathbabe.org, and of the new book, Weapons of Math Destruction. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and we've heard a lot of complaints about the American election system this year. Micro-targeting, dark money, vote rigging, gerrymandering. But today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're going to put aside the problems and focus instead on solutions. Ingenious, off-the-wall, counterintuitive ideas for making American elections better, fairer, and more fun. Now, some of them are going to sound a little crazy, like letting 10-year-olds vote. Or making people pay to vote. Philosopher Jason Brennan's idea is to roll back democracy and only let a few people vote. He told Steve Paulson that's because the average American just doesn't know enough.
The average voter in the United States knows who the president is and pretty much nothing else. They can't really identify who their congresspeople are. They don't know much about ideology. They don't really know much about the social sciences. They don't know the basic facts that might be relevant to the election. And non-voters, the people who stay home, they know even less.
So you're saying that those ignorant voters, that's your word, they shouldn't be allowed to vote, right?
I think it's worth thinking about alternatives to just straight democratic voting, where we give everybody an equal right to vote regardless of their background knowledge. And maybe to kind of soften people up on this, think about the following. Why don't we allow 8-year-olds to vote? So I have a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they're not legally allowed to vote. Why don't we let them? So two reasons people might give. One is that they think they're under the influence of their parents. But the other thing people will say is, well, those kids don't know anything. Why should they vote? They're ignorant. They can vote later when they know something, but they don't know anything right now. But the adults aren't really much better.
So you want a system where basically only the high information voters are allowed to vote, right?
Well, there's a number of different ways of doing this. So the technical term for this kind, any of these sorts of systems, was dubbed by a philosopher named David Esland at Brown University. It's called epistocracy. So that comes from the Greek word episteme, meaning knowledge, and krasi, meaning like rule of or power of.
So this is the rule of the knowledgeable.
Yeah, that's right. So in a democracy, every citizen has equal voting rights sort of by law. In an epistocracy, in one way or another, citizens can acquire more power in virtue of knowing more. So one way of doing that is to give everyone a right to vote. But if people have certain credentials or if they pass a quiz, they might acquire an additional right to vote. So this is a system that the economist John Stuart Mill advocated in the 1800s. Another way would be by default, no one has any right to vote. But if you pass a quiz, you can acquire a right to vote. Another system that's been advocated by a Mexican philosopher named Claudio Lopez Guerra is what's called the enfranchisement lottery, where by default, no one has any right to vote. And then right before the election, you select about 20,000 citizens at random, and they and only they acquire the right to vote, but only if they first go through some very basic competence building exercise. And finally, a system which sounds kind of convoluted, but I really like the idea of it, is what I call government by simulated oracle. And in a system like that, what happens is everyone gets to vote. But when you vote, you take a quiz of basic knowledge, you write down your demographic information, and then you write down your policy preferences, or you vote for a candidate or something like that. But then instead of just taking what the people actually support, you use that information to statistically determine what would happen to the American public if they could score 100% on that quiz. So in fact, they'll probably score like 30% on average. But if I magically were to ramp up their knowledge to 100%, what would they support? And if you have those three bits of information and you have, you know, 20,000 people voting, and really hundreds of thousands or millions of people voting in the real world, you can then determine, and anyone who's taken statistics could determine, what would the people support if they were knowledgeable? And the idea here is you do that rather than the thing they in fact support.
Of course, the problem is, historically, this is a really fraught question because there were certain groups that were excluded. I mean, for a long time, African Americans weren't allowed to vote. Women were not allowed to vote. And then later on, even once African Americans were given the vote, at least in the South, they had to pass certain tests to prove that they were competent. And given all of these systems that you, or most of the systems that you've just proposed, I don't see how you get away from the inherent problem of an epistocracy, that it would seem to favor people with more education, higher incomes. In our society, people who are mostly white, aren't these going to be the people who basically end up ruling the country?
Yeah, that's right. So at least one system, the government by simulated oracle and also the enfranchisement lottery, those are designed in a way that can overcome that problem sort of inherently. But the other systems will be ones that will have that issue. It might not be quite as bad as we think. So one is to think of it as a comparison thing. In the U.S. right now, despite it being democratic, it still is the case that high income, high IQ, employed, richer people, privileged people run things. So even thinking about, you know, the worry about high income voters or privileged people voting, it's worth noting a couple interesting features about democracy. So one is, voters don't vote selfishly. We tend to think we do. Everyone believes that he or she votes for what they perceive as justice, but everyone else is a jerk voting for their pocketbooks. When political scientists study this, they find that voters vote altruistically. They vote for what they perceive to be the common good of their nation. So people tend to vote altruistically, and that's true of both parties. It's true of pretty much every ideology. The question is whether they measure up in terms of cognition.
Now, it seems that the devil's in the details here. And so, I mean, in terms of this question of political competency, who gets to set those standards of knowledge? I mean, I can't imagine constructing a test to sort of, you know, determine whether someone is up to speed or not that all sides would agree to. I mean, there are huge controversies, for instance, about what gets into school textbooks about how to teach U.S. history, and the stakes here would be so much higher, and I would think so much more controversial in terms of which questions and answers get put into these competency tests.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I don't think there's any really way to avoid that, to be honest. One way to get around that is to make it fairly basic and just require knowledge of particular facts, just what's the unemployment rate, what's happened to the economy in the past year. Can you name your current congressperson? Can you name how many people are on the Supreme Court? Just very, very basic things.
Why do some the of nice the, like, is, even like, what's the unemployment rate? Why do I need to know that to be able to vote? I mean, it's just, I don't see why that should determine anything.
Well, think about the recent Brexit vote as an illustration of this. So you can think about what facts would be relevant to Brexit. Something like, how many immigrants are there in the UK? How much money is going back and forth between the UK and the rest of the EU? And here's an interesting finding. So they ask all the voters in the UK, how many immigrants are there? What percentage of the UK is made up of immigrants? The people who voted leave estimated that it was something like 40%. And the people who voted stay estimated that it was something like 20%. And the truth was about 10%. So you look at the basic facts that might be relevant to the election, what's happening to the economy. And if people have those facts wrong, they're going to make mistakes about what we should do.
So in the Brexit case, you're saying that those ignorant people who just got everything totally wrong, they should not have been allowed to vote, and Brexit vote would not have been approved.
If we did have a system in which, suppose your knowledge of the relevant facts were in some way empowered you, it was conditional upon your knowledge of the relevant facts, then yeah, they would have voted stay. And even afterwards, you can see regret from the voters because after the Brexit was decided, a lot of these facts were published and people started studying them and they're like, wow, I guess I didn't understand how many immigrants there were and I didn't really understand what the economic value of trade with the EU is.
So you've presented various alternatives to democracy. I mean, sort of this rule of the knowledgeable that you are calling for. Is any of this happening anywhere in the world? I mean, do we have any case studies of successes here?
No, not really. But, you know, there are things that we could do that are legal, I think, that would get us closer to being an epistocratic system. So suppose you had a rule, and many people who consider themselves ardent Democrats, pro-democracy, are okay with this rule. We change the voting age, and you're allowed to vote only, say, between the ages of 30 and 50. So really old people and really young people can't vote.
You can get drafted and sent off to war at 18, but you can't vote till you're 30.
Yeah. Well, I oppose the draft too, by the way. So let's get rid of that while we're at it. If you had just that rule, that would make the American voting populace much better informed because that's the age group at which people have the highest information. Really young people and really old people tend to be very low information. Middle-aged people have higher degrees of information. That, I think, is probably consistent with the 14th Amendment, whereas some of the stuff that we're talking about would require a radical change in the Constitution. It wouldn't be constitutional.
It sounds like, I mean, partly what you're trying to do here is you're trying to say, okay, it's not exactly clear if there's a better system, but let's take a really hard look at democracy because it's not as great as everyone thinks it is.
Look, we don't really know if epistocracy will work better. In the same way, if you were writing in the late 1700s and you said we should have democracy instead of monarchy, you didn't really have good support for that. You had some theoretical kinds of claims. You had some sort of mathematical arguments. But at the same time, like when you look around in, say, the late 1700s, you have two sort of democracies, the U.S. And France was a disaster, and the U.S. wasn't obviously any better off than it had been under British monarchical rule. So later, after we actually experiment with democracy, it becomes clear that overall it works better than the alternatives. So I think something like that's going with epistocracy. We can look at problems with democracy. We can theorize about how epistocracy might improve upon it. But we would never know for sure unless we actually experimented with it in the real world.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for listening.
Steve Paulson talked with Jason Brennan, a philosopher at Georgetown University and author of Against Democracy. We're talking Elections 2.0 here on To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you want to know what a state-of-the-art election system looks like, forget about the U.S. Look around the world. Check out what some of our democratic neighbors are doing. Or you could just call Pippa Norris. She runs the Electoral Integrity Project at Harvard and the University of Sydney, and it monitors elections in 153 countries. She told Raymond Tungekar that a lot of them do a better job than the U.S.
What we do is we rank all elections worldwide. And so you obviously have the cases like Sweden and Norway, but they're kind of predictable, the fact that they have good elections. There are also a whole bunch of newer democracies which managed to do very well, like Estonia, Lithuania, Costa Rica.
Slovenia, that surprised me. I didn't realize that they had more reliable elections than us.
They do. Even very poor countries like Benin and Cape Verde in Africa managed to have very good elections according to our expert assessments. And we've kind of lagged behind.
Well, what I found shocking about your research is the U.S. ranked among the worst among
That's
Western
right.
democracies, which to me, I was just shocked by that. Why is that? Why did we score so low?
So worldwide, 153 countries that we've ranked so far in all the elections, and the U.S. ranks 52nd, and it's the worst of all the established democracies. In America, it's to do with how elections are run, and it's the partisan nature that we expect basically partisan officials to run impartial local administration. And there's a conflict of interest in that. And then the second reason, we don't have a single body. So look over the border to Canada. And they have Elections Canada, which has a tremendous reputation. Canada is also obviously a federal country with provinces, each of whom have different units running elections. But Elections Canada sets the standards, provides civic education, it provides training, it looks at the procedures which are used as well as the electoral laws, and oversees also any complaints or problems which are likely to arise. And it's a very impartial unit.
Hmm. So it sounds like you're saying that the way our elections are set up are so decentralized, and there's so many, it's down to the state and local level that I guess it just makes me wonder, can an American election be rigged?
So remember, this is also an asset in the sense that to rig it, you'd actually have to do it across all of these local precincts. So the broad intentional vote rigging is really off the table. But just think about this. So you're a Russian hacker, and you know that Pennsylvania or Florida or any of the other states is going to be close, and you go into one Broward County, say, and you do have some sort of access to hacking the official register, so when people turn up to vote, they find their names aren't listed, even though they got official notification. Now, that could cause immediately chaos, and it could create a tremendous army of lawyers, obviously.
Huh, but, I mean, could that really happen?
I think we shouldn't underestimate the fact that elections are kind of the dusty corner of public administration in America. A lot of our technology was bought in 2002. It was the Help America Vote Act. And Congress, after Florida, produced a lot of money, about $6 billion, and many states took that up and they bought their machines, but they haven't been updated. And some of the machines that were bought are running Windows 2000.
Really?
This is the land meant to be the internet, which we discovered, but we're way behind when it comes to local. And remember, of course, local administration, they're very reluctant to spend money on this because you only have an election every 2 years. And they've got many other things they're trying to spend money on. So it often gets very low down in people's priorities until you get something go wrong, in which case everybody gets worried.
Well, there's another problem that seems pretty unsolvable. I mean, right now, both Republicans and Democrats have different concerns, right? I mean, Republicans are primarily concerned about too many people voting fraudulently, whereas Democrats are concerned about voters being unfairly excluded from voting. But there's a piece that you wrote recently where you suggest that those issues don't actually have to be mutually exclusive. How so?
So, for example, if we had a system whereby you had to have voter ID, but the state issued that to everybody on the voter register, and it issued it free, and it issued it well ahead, effectively, to distribute to everybody, then you'd have a card with a photo on it, and then when you go to the polls, that photo should also be listed on the voter register. Many countries do this. For example, India, one of the poorest countries, has 800 million people voting, right? You can imagine the incredible challenges of doing that. It has 1 million polling workers. And yet, when the Indian voter goes to vote, there's their photo ID and there's their photo on the voter register. So it's not basically rocket science, right? And then for the people, in particular Democrats who are concerned about voter inclusion, I think, again, we have to say, of course, that has to be part of the American tradition. We're a country which believes that everybody who's eligible should vote. And we should really make sure that there are convenient voting facilities which are secure. These aren't trade-offs. They're things that we can come together. And we just need to get rid of the bitterness of the process right now.
Well, I want to run another idea by you, one that, you know, a lot of countries around the world have implemented. Mandatory voting, where voting is like filing a tax return. It's, you know, it's required by law.
Right.
In your estimation, does that work?
So part of my time I spend every year in Sydney, in Australia, where they have compulsory voting, mandatory voting. It has pros and cons. On the one hand, you obviously do improve turnout, especially if there's some sort of fine or sanction for not voting. Now, not every country with mandatory voting actually has a real sanction. But if you have that, then most people do vote. And so right now our vote could go up a lot, maybe by even 30%. Against that, you have to say it changes the incentives for how people behave. So you might get many people voting who aren't actually that concerned about the outcome, might not know that much about. They might make more of an effort if they know they have to vote, but that's not guaranteed. In addition, the parties actually spend and the candidates spend less time canvassing because they know people are going to vote, they have much less effort. So our get-out-the-vote drives, which is a tremendous asset in civic society, if you bring in compulsory voting, then to some extent they'll, you know, cut back on that.
So let's say, you know, a new country just popped up on the map with its own citizens, and they ask you, Pippa Norris, to devise an equitable and functional voting system. What would that look like?
Well, I do quite a bit of consultancy around the world, and I used to work for UNDP, heading up the democratic governance, so I've got a bit of experience of this. Again, think about America. What we have is a winner-take-all system. And we've always known in political science, if you have a winner-take-all, meaning that one side wins, the other side loses, it's a majoritarian, and it's a presidential system, it really does increase the bitterness of any outcome. And it makes it very difficult to actually for the losers to accept it. So other countries have other types of electoral systems. Simplest one is proportional representation. In that, you don't vote in your district for a single candidate. Instead, you vote for the party. The party will put up a list of its candidates in that district. And what that does is it's actually much easier to have many more parties. So the smaller parties who are right now basically written out of the race, whether they're the Greens or Libertarians, they would stand a chance because their votes would be much more proportional to their representation in Congress. So it gives everybody a much fairer allocation of votes to seats, and it means it's less of a winner-take-all system.
Pippa Norris talking with Raymond Tungekar. She runs the Electoral Integrity Project at Harvard and the University of Sydney, and she's the author of Why Elections Fail. So elections as we know them were invented in the 17th century by people who still wrote with quill pens. They didn't have computers, algorithms, advanced statistics, mathematical modeling, or big data. We do. And you would think that by now someone would have used them to come up with some more technologically advanced way to elect leaders. And actually, someone has. His name is Glenn Weil. He's an economist at Microsoft Research in New York, and he has invented a whole new formula for collective decision-making. It's called quadratic voting. And in a nutshell, it's a way to make people pay for their votes. So what does he have against the old-fashioned one-person, one-vote majority rule?
Well, I think my favorite example is that there's a great quote from a German theologian during the Nazi period where they said, you know, first they came for the Jews, but I was not a Jew. And then they came for the communists, but I was not a communist. And then they came for the socialists, but I was not a socialist. And so you can have this thing where, you know, 51% of people deny 49% their rights, and then 51% of the remaining deny the remaining 49% of the rights. And you end up in just a terrible state where you have a few people controlling everything through what sounds like a perfectly democratic procedure, which I think is a way of saying that, while superficially, the majority rule sounds great, it sounds like equality. Once you actually follow through the full logic of it, you realize it's something that nobody wants.
So how is your system, quadratic voting, how is it different?
You can just think of quadratic voting as a way of finding compromises. You know, if you're bargaining for a job and you are trying to figure out how much sick leave do I get, what are my wages going to be, you always have to give up on some things in exchange for other things that are more important to you. I always find that a really important process for me. Because you realize, what do you prioritize? What are you willing to give up? You need to reach a deal with someone, an agreement. And that's not how our politics works, you know? Our politics is just, here's how I feel. But if we're forced to prioritize, figure out what's more important to us, if that was core to our political discussion, we would have, I think, a much more rational politics.
Okay, I'm not sure I'm following this. Explain how this would work and what's a vote going to cost? Where does the money come in?
So everyone would have a currency that would be given to them, you know, equally across all people. So you'd have like a pile of chips, and you'd be able to use those to vote, let's say, on a number of referenda. In California, where I grew up, we always have half a dozen or more referenda on the ballot each year. And imagine that legalizing marijuana is very important to me, but I don't really care about marriage equality. I might choose to put many of my votes on legalizing marijuana and not to vote on the marriage equality issue, and then maybe there would be a budgetary issue or whatever else.
So it sounds like instead of having just one vote, you get 10, and then you can decide, you know, how you might apportion those. Maybe you care so much about the presidential election that you're going to put all 10 of your chips down for one of the presidential candidates, and then you can't vote in, on any of the others. Or maybe you care much more about, I don't know, your congressional representative, and so you're going to put all your chips there. Is that what you're talking
about? Yeah, exactly. So you're going in the right direction, but the key catch, which comes in with the quadratic nature, is that you're never going to want to put everything on one thing. And here's the reason. The rule for what you pay is not that one vote costs one chip. It's that the first vote on any issue costs one chip. The second vote is going to cost you three more chips, so it'll be four in total. And the third vote will cost you five more chips, so it'll be nine in total.
Why do it that way?
So the problem was, if you just let people allocate their chips as they want, people put almost all their resources onto the one issue they care most about. And that would very clearly lead to the dictatorship of the people who really are obsessed with an issue. But under quadratic voting, rather than just looking at the people who care the most or giving everyone equal weight, everyone gets weight in proportion to the importance of the issue to them.
How might this play out in, say, a presidential election? Like, what if we had quadratic voting right now in this presidential election?
So you could have many more candidates running and not have to worry about this whole thing of, oh, it just has to be Trump versus Clinton. Because under quadratic voting, not only would it be the case that you would have this quadratic rule and the ability to allocate, but you could vote either in favor of or against candidates. So candidates who were widely despised by everyone, as at least one, probably both of our leading candidates are right now, would have, find it very hard to compete against alternatives, because even if people thought that they were had a reasonable shot at winning, people would vote against them strongly enough to bring the other candidates ahead.
How do you vote against someone?
Well, you vote negative. So under the system, each one of the candidates, you would have a choice to allocate your chips to get votes that would be in favor of them or against them. And the person with the largest number of net votes in favor would win. So putting aside our current election, if you think about some of the great, terrible things that have happened during history when, you know, the Nazis were elected in Germany, it was because many people were afraid that the communists would take over. And so they voted in favor of the Nazis just to stop the communists. And many people voted in favor of the communists just to stop the Nazis. And if you had a system where you could vote against both of them, that sort of scenario wouldn't arise.
At a philosophical level, it seems to me that you're basically talking about turning democracy into a market-based system. I mean, turning votes into a form of currency and assigning a market value to them. I guess I'm wondering, aren't there some things, you know, like the ballot box, that should be market-free?
So, and this may be a very extreme view, but I think the answer is no. I actually think that most of the problems that we perceive as society as maybe outcomes of the market or the reasons why, you know, we have inequality and things like this are actually a result of us not having enough markets. I guess since I was a child, I always had this passion for politics to make the world a better place and whatever. And like many people, I thought I knew how to do that. I thought I knew X program that was advocated by one party that would make things better. I was very confident about it. And the more I learned, the more I realized how flawed all of these programs were and how little they really could accomplish and how impoverished our political and social and economic imaginations are. A large part of what motivates me is just seeing how the social machine could work better.
Glenn Weil is an economist and senior researcher at Microsoft Research in New York. He's the co-founder of a startup called Collective Decision Engines, which is developing quadratic voting for civic and commercial use. Coming up, imagine a world in which fifth graders could vote. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about radical ideas for reinventing elections. And the one that I haven't been able to stop thinking about is let kids vote. Political scientist Jonathan Bernstein makes the case for lowering the voting age to birth, age zero. Charles Monroe Kane asked if that isn't completely bizarre.
In fact, it's more odd that we don't have vote from birth than that we do. If back in the 16th century or 17th century or whatever, when they first started voting, we had vote for birth and just assumed that parents would take care of it until the kids were old enough to act for themselves, we would think it's completely normal. Nobody would think it's weird. And in fact, people would think it's really horrible to take away the vote from babies and infants and toddlers and 10-year-olds.
Oh, my gosh. I have a million follow-up questions to what you just said. So let's just argue that tomorrow we lower the voting age to zero. How would it work?
Presumably, parents would act on behalf of their kids up to some age, and you could have various different rules for it. You could say up to 10-year-old, 15-year-old, whatever, 6-year-old, up to the point where they were tall enough to stand, to get up to the button and press it themselves, or whatever. I'm not actually convinced that babies should vote. I just think it's an interesting idea. I do think that 14-year-olds should vote, and 12-year-olds.
But why?
Let me back up slightly and say one way of looking at voting and why we have democracy in the first place is because participation in how we organize our own lives is good in its own self. It's something humans can do, is to organize collectively how they live their lives. If we think of it that way, then the case for one-year-olds voting is not so strong. But the case for young people voting, for 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 14-year-olds, someplace in there, becomes a strong case because that's when you learn, that's when you start being able to make decisions and participate. Maybe not the best decisions, but we don't in a democracy test to see whether people are going to make the best decisions before they vote.
It's so interesting. I was thinking about myself at, let's say, 14 or 15 years old. And one way, I think, God, I was such an idiot. On another way, I think to myself, my gosh, if there was an election when I was 14, that person's going to be my president for the next 4 years, maybe 8 years, and all those decisions are going to affect me, but I won't be able to have any control over them. And I should have a right.
Oh, it's worse than that.
Yeah.
It's worse than that. Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court was nominated by Ronald Reagan in 1987, I think.
Right.
So, you know, the past has a lot of influence over what we do today, and our kids are stuck with it. And why should they be?
Do you think this is realistic? I mean, do you think that there's a chance that we could lower the age back down?
There have been a couple of initiatives. There's one, I believe, in San Francisco right now to lower it to 16. I do know that Tacoma Park, Maryland, suburb of Washington, D.C., lowered the voting age to 16 a couple years ago. And again, that's only for local elections. The constitutional requirement is a minimum. You can't, no state, Texas, Wisconsin can't say you have to be 20 to vote. The Constitution says 18. But if Wisconsin wants to say 12 or 14 or 17, they can do that.
And it seems to me what you're saying philosophically is that it's not about the vote at the moment for the 10-year-old or the 14-year-old or the 3-year-old. It's about empowering that vote for the future for democracy. Am I getting that correct?
Yeah. It's about making participation in democracy part of their lives before you get to teenage years where you are worried about a whole lot of other things. And the first thing we tell kids who are studying this stuff in school, and they have to, they don't have any choice about it because they don't have a vote. But the first thing we tell them is, oh, yeah, you can start voting you know, 10 years from now or 6 years from now or whatever, you have no voice right now. I think that the lesson would be more powerful in schools if they did have, and, you know, and tell them, oh, and that's that thing you did with your parents last time. Here's why it matters.
It'd be more fun to be a civics teacher in high school, wouldn't it, if that was going on?
I think so.
Yeah.
Jonathan Bernstein is a Bloomberg View columnist and author of A Plain Blog About Politics. He talked with Charles Monroe Cain. And our last interview today is actually with a civics teacher who says fun is what's missing from American elections.
What has been missing is this deep sense that participation in politics and engagement in civic life and voting in particular ought to be a joyful communal experience.
This is Eric Liu. He's the founder of Citizen University, a nonprofit that aims to reinvigorate the culture of voting by reintroducing Americans, us, to our own civic power.
Actually, for most of American history, until pretty much the advent of television, there was this deep, robust, raucous participatory culture of voting that was about street theater and parties and open-air debates and festivals and competing parades and theatricality and spectacle. If you think back to some of the signal moments in American political history, the pre-revolutionary era, and you think about this very fertile, fervent culture of pamphleteering and outdoor orations. And then you fast forward to something like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and, you know, that was the entertainment of its day.
Can you tell me about a couple of the projects that you've gotten started? You've got this whole Make Elections, Make Voting Fun Again campaign at a pretty local level.
This is a project called The Joy of Voting. So in Miami, one of the projects is about young people organizing these all-night dance parties with really great DJs and performers, where the only way you get in is to show that you're registered to vote. In Akron, Ohio, kids are creating plays about elections and politics, and they're performing these plays on the back of a pickup truck that goes from neighborhood to neighborhood throughout Akron. In Philadelphia, there's a great scavenger hunt that is elections-themed all through Colonial Old Town. And in Wichita, local residents and artists are creating mixtapes and graffiti art that's about both getting out the vote and reminding people why voting matters. And again, in the best sense, what voting is, the bigger picture that voting is part of.
Why does that bodies in the street thing matter to you? Why does it matter to you that this is in person, in a place?
That's such a great question. You know, I think it matters particularly in our age where so much of our lives, are mediated and we deal with one another through our screens. We literally are not seeing each other with our heads and necks craned looking down at our smartphones. And although social media makes many wonderful things possible at a scale and with a speed that wasn't previously possible, if you think about the emergence of both the Tea Party and Black Lives Matter, or, you know, groups like Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, all these things emerged out of social media, and that's great. But at the end of the day, just as at the beginning of the day, face-to-face matters most in democracy. Democracy and self-government are about relationships. They're about the capacity for seeing one another, empathizing with one another. You know, I think in a country as diverse and far-flung as ours, there is so little naturally holding us together. And the only way to build these deep bonds of trust is to see one another.
Yeah, that's such an interesting comment because I'm thinking about how many people today, and sometimes I'm one of them, feel pretty cynical about the entire democratic process in America and don't really think their individual votes are going to matter all that much. You know, the deck is already stacked. The campaigns are run by a cadre of professional operatives. They're supported by armies of big data miners and funded by special interests and big money. And on the face of that, wearing an I voted sticker just that seems kind of futile.
I don't deny that it seems kind of futile. But the two responses I have are number one, it may feel that way in a national election where votes are counted in the tens of millions. But where this really matters, think about your town, your city, your community. In a country where in most local elections, turnout hovers at about 20%. If you decided that you wanted to get you and your friends' friends to actually vote and show up in a local election, just you and your social network literally could turn the tide in a local election. That's enough to get a different kind of council member, to get a different kind of interest represented, to get a different array of power at your local level.
Well, this is the real underlying issue, isn't it? It's about power. And you've said in a bunch of different places that one of the big problems you think facing American democracy right now is that a lot of Americans have become illiterate in power. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. You know, I think power, just that word. I mean, I bet some of our listeners, as we're talking about this now, you know, their hackles have gone up. Power is a dirty word in American life. And all of our associations with power are kind of negative. People are power hungry or power mad or on power trips. And I think one of the most basic responsibilities that we have as citizens is to be able, with unflinching eyes, to name, to understand, to be able to read and write power. This is going to sound a little bit philosophical, maybe even spiritual, but I think it is simply a truth, which is that power is a gift. We begin with a certain measure of power, all of us, even the ones who seem to have the least in material ways. And consciously or not, we are continuously either giving that power away or we are directing it and circulating it intentionally. For instance, back to voting, when you decide that, boy, the system is so rigged and the choices are terrible and this whole thing is corrupt, I'm not going to bother voting, that's a fantasy. There is no such thing as not voting.
What do you mean?
Not voting is voting. It is voting to hand over your power and your voice to other people whose interests are most likely going to be inimical to your own. There is no passivity in this stuff.
Why does the local level matter so much in this?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. And number one, even though so much of American politics has become nationalized by talking points machines and the professionals you alluded to and our kind of national media, at the end of the day, you know, we live in a place where things are either going to work or not, right? There isn't a Republican or a Democratic way to collect garbage. There isn't a way that can be just reduced to party posturing on the question of how you deal with traffic or how you deal with homelessness. These are hard, unavoidable, concrete choices, trade-offs, and problems that a community living together has to deal with. And so if you think about just the simple question, who runs your town? Who runs your town? I don't mean just who's the mayor, who's the city manager. If you do kind of a more extensive mapping of power in your town, and you think about, well, it's these developers, or it's this university president, or mm-hmm. it's this really, you know, billionaire, or it's this union boss, or whatever it might be, the question of who runs this town is one that you're far more able to change not only the narrative of, but the facts on the ground of by participating.
Is that what you mean when you talk about becoming power literate as opposed to power illiterate? Simply knowing to begin with, say, mapping the power in your local community. How much do you know about it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, we use a phrase oftentimes in everyday life. We talk about the power structure, right? But what is the power structure? I break down the power structure into this combination of sources of power plus the conduits of power. You know, there are various sources of power, whether that's money power, people power, the power of force and violence, the power of state action, the power of social norms, right? There are all these different sources, but what are the conduits through which they flow? In some communities, the main conduits are going to be formal channels like the Chamber of Commerce or the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. In other communities, it's not going to be that so much. The conduits of power are going to be, you know, this lunch table at the steakhouse where the third Tuesday of every month, you know, a few bankers and big shots get together and map out what's going to happen. Mapping those sources and conduits is what I mean by being literate in power, being literally able to see these flows all around you. It's like, you remember the movie The Matrix at the end when the Matrix becomes visible, right, to Neo, and you see that continuous stream of data and bits and the flow all around you. Like, just envision that, man. I mean, that's happening all around us. And if we start seeing that flow, that suffusing flow of power and our ability actually to redirect it, that changes both mindset and action.
To circle back to a couple of things we began with, fun and adding a sense of play back to the whole electoral democratic process and the notion of imagination. You created an exercise a while ago, a kind of thought experiment that you challenged people to try. And I wanted to invite our listeners to do this, and maybe you could explain.
Sure. One of the most simple, well, simple but challenging exercises I think we as citizens can do is just to write a narrative of what your city could look like in the future. How, if power were truly circulated equitably and people had more wherewithal, more opportunity to participate more fully in the civic life of your community, what would that look like? Paint that picture. That is an act of imagination, as almost any moment of transformation in politics demands and requires. And when you begin to depict what that city looks like, and it can be in 3 years, it can be in 30 years, but when you begin to make that depiction in your mind and then start telling that story to other people, I mean this in the most profound sense, it becomes self-fulfilling, right? Any political movement of the last half century, whether it was the conservative movement or the civil rights movement, all of these movements began with people basically telling and writing down this kind of narrative, envisioning what that polity of the future would look like, and then working backwards from that and thinking, okay, who and what do we need to mobilize in order to get from here to there?
Eric Liu is the founder and CEO of Citizen University. He was a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for Bill Clinton. That's it for now, but there's always more in our podcast feed. Look for us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Our producers are Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Doug Gordon. We had editorial help this week from the folks at theconversation.com. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.